This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net. That's thebdr.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
Compressors and limiters and clippers, oh my. We're talking multi-band processing for AM, FM, and codecs.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? Yeah, all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And joining me from New York City, it's Chris Tobin. Plus our special guest, Cornelius Gould.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host for the show. Along with us on the show today, we have Chris Tobin, who is a technical manager at CBS Radio in New York City. Also, our special guest this week is Cornelius Gould, Corny Gould. He works with the R&D department at Omnia Audio in Cleveland, Ohio. Well, as we said, I'm Kirk Harnack, the host of the show, and we had a little problem recording the show this week at the very beginning. We missed a few minutes of the first part of the show, and so that's why I just did the introductions for the co-host, Chris, and for Corny Gould, our guest. So now we're going to join the conversation in progress with Corny telling us about his development of audio processing.
I made when I was designing the processor, the last processor design, where I started thinking more in terms of what is it that I'm actually doing. I'm using a diode here. What are the characteristics of this diode? What is it really doing, and what does it mean to the rest of this circuit? And from that exercise, I managed to be able to come up with a description of a very detailed description of how each part and piece worked in that processor, and which came in handy when it came time to come up with a way to describe that to a machine.
Okay, so you got all that. You got all that together. You described it to a machine.
Mm-hmm.
Any of this? Where is it being used now? Is it in the products that people can buy?
It
can
is
this,
right now.
Handiwork somewhere.
This work that I've been working on is all now happening in the back rooms at Omnia Audio.
Oh, okay. So it's still the skunk works, black box. Nothing
yes.
has come out
yes.
yet.
Yes, exactly.
So you're teasing. This is a tease.
You're teasing.
you're being an audio processing geek, and you're teasing those of us who played with the DAP 310s, the R-band, the Upmon 8000s, and opened them up and did the little, futsing around with capacitors and resistors and made our things sound unique. And then Bob
and I did a lot of that too.
Amplification. We all did. And if you didn't do it, you shouldn't be doing audio processing with DSPs.
Exactly.
It's like saying it's like I build houses. Have you ever used cement or concrete? No, then don't build a house.
Yes. Exactly.
I use new polymers to build this. Really? Have you ever used basic adhesives? No. Get away from me.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. I'm excited with all this stuff because I've had the opportunity to hear a lot of DSP-based audio processors, and I've enjoyed some of the things I've done with them, Omnia products being one of them, and the competing Orban and Wheatstone and the others out there. But what you're describing sounds even like it's like this is the next level. It's like, it's like the we're in 2001 Space Odyssey, 2010, and now it's the next step, 2250. Is that where things are going for your back office work? I mean, sometime in the next two quarters we'll see something come on the market or no?
I'm hoping that's the case. I mean, we're real close to unveiling some things pretty soon, it's just been crazy. A lot of it's brand new hardware to do with what's going on here, because existing stuff just can't do it. It just doesn't have the horsepower to do it.
Speaking of horsepower. What's the latency like with the work you've been doing? Because this is what fascinates me now. Everything is going digital, and one of my hobbies is amateur radio and communications equipment. And what I'm discovering is a lot of digital radio stuff is the latency is starting to grow considerably. How much latency do you find develops when you start to get the DSPs working to the way you say, like it's almost like they're self-aware of the audio coming into the box, going out, each spectral part of the audio band is being manipulated or massaged? how long does it take for it to go from in to out?
Well, that's the fun part. Certainly, there's ways you can do audio processing where if you take enough time, you can do almost anything with the audio and make it sound great.
I understand that.
But that's not what many people want. So the approach that I take is that there's a lot going on, but I stay close to analog-type restrictions where the delay through the box is not that much more than it is with any current box out there. In the Omni,
so you're trying to be the Van Gogh of audio processing. I see. Okay.
Corny, in designing a DSP audio processor, what are some of the processes that you're putting the audio through that take time, that you really can't scrape any time off of? Things that just in the physical world of analyzing bits, what takes time to get done?
Probably the longest time there is in an audio processor currently on the market is comes from when you use devices such as look-ahead limiters, where the concept behind that is you want to have precision control, but you don't want to use a clipper. And in the case of HD radio, which brings it back to the topic we were talking about earlier, the technology there, you need the audio to be, the waveforms of the audio to be as pure as possible. And if you were to clip it, which is what has been done for years and years and years with analog radio, and just to back up a little bit, for those who do not have the benefit of looking at my site while they're listening to the podcast here, what a clipper does, it's like a brute force level control device, but it is distortion. And you can... a parallel to that would be like a guitar distortion pedal, where if the guitar cranks in enough distortion, the guitar sounds louder and louder and louder, but it also sounds more distorted. And guitar pedal makers play games where they can shape the distortion and make it sound more pleasing to your ear, maybe take off some of the rough harmonics here and a little bit over there. And while it doesn't sound like the original guitar, it sounds cool in its own sense. And a lot of that is done in a different way for radio, for analog radio, where you would clip, deliberately distort the audio, and then you shape the distortion in a way where it sounds pleasing to the ear at that level of loudness.
Mm.
Or at least we hope you do. Or we hope it does. And so the problem is when you do that, you do generate a lot of hash and a lot of garbage that wasn't there before, even though it sounds okay to our ears. And it works okay with the analog medium. A codec, which is a device, a digital device, which throws away most of the information in the audio and tries to reconstruct something that sounds like the regular audio with very few bits, has a hard time with that because it just doesn't. When you throw away most of the information, you can't reconstruct all this little distortion, all these little things that we don't normally notice, it will notice. And when you try to put that, strip out, say, 90% of the information and put it back together, you know, 10% of that to make a full-sounding audio, there's a lot of crud in there. It just sounds horrible unless it's pristine, pure audio.
Mm-hmm.
So so a look-ahead limiter is a device where you can get that same kind of control that you would with a clipper, but what you have to do in that is you have to see how long it takes for your level control algorithm to run, which is the device that says, hey, this audio is too loud, I've got to turn things down. Oh, it's too quiet, I have to turn it back up. Well, that kind of a scheme takes a little bit of time to react. So what you do is you find out what that time is and design the audio in such a way where it's delayed by that amount. So by the time the unit has a chance to react, the audio would match up in time to that reaction point where you get precision control.
Hmm.
So that's one of the longest lengths of time that's taken up in DSP. And that's something that was done in analog over the years, but it certainly is done much better in DSP because you can delay the audio longer to make things match up precision-wise. And there's certain filters. There's filters in DSP that are equivalent to analog filters called IIR filters. They take some time to process, but not that much more time than analog. Then you have these FIR filters, which are superior in many ways, but take a long time to calculate.
Tell us what that means. What's an FIR filter?
FIR, finite impulse response filter stands for. And what it does is that it has the characteristics where you have you're not creating as many or you're not creating any phase distortion or group delay distortion with your audio with those. And the advantage you get with those is that things, when you split your audio into several pieces or do work in filtered limited bandwidth chunks, when you put it all back together, things tend to fall right back into place again without much disruption. And they're great, but the penalty to using those is a long time delay.
When you're designing these DSP algorithms, are you using something like MATLAB?
Yes, I certainly have that in my tool case of games. Yeah. Yes,
I was just this whole notion of finite impulse response filters is just amazing. I happened to look that up on Wikipedia, and there's what a lot of overhead here. Gee, man.
Yes. That's the kind of stuff that takes a while to get your head around.
I see. There's the window design method, the frequency sampling method, the weighted least squares design. The Minimax design, and here's a term that ought to be patented, the Equiripple design.
Yes.
Wow.
This
is all stuff you didn't have to know about in the analog world.
Yeah, because your only option really was just the standard analog filter, which was the equivalent to the digital equivalent to that would be the IIR filter or infinite impulse response filter.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yep. Well, so we're in the DSP world now. And by the way, Chris asked you a question. You know, what's come out of the work that you've been doing at Omnia for a year and a half, 2 years now almost? You've been with our company?
And a lot of this is me carrying on work that I was already in the middle of before I came into Omnia as well. Mm. So
I want to take a moment and mention that a certain number of listeners that we have on the podcast certainly are owners of Omnia audio processors. And Corny, some people, I guess probably 80%, 90% of people are happy with the presets that come with an audio processor, whether it be an Orban processor or one of our Omnia processors. But you went in to the Omnia 6 and the Omnia 1, and you developed a whole additional set of presets that I think you're probably tweaking some controls that the users don't have access to. And
yes,
you've put these presets on your website at cgould.com. And can people just download these and put them into their Omnia audio processor?
Yes, as far as the older Omnia, such as the Omnia 6, you will have to. There's instructions on there that the things just to watch out for, because it only has so many slots for presets or user presets. So you have to follow those instructions very closely and make sure you do what I mentioned in there. The newer box, the Omnia 1, doesn't have that problem. You can just load up until it says, "Okay, stop now." But there's all kinds of processing in there, processing out presets for people to try for various formats. And it sounds like you had another question, Kirk.
Well, I've mentioned these presets that you've done on your website to a few Omnia users, and those who have tried them have been delighted with them, because it is a different sound than than the sound of an Omnia processor. To me, Omnia processors out of the factory have a very clear and accurate sound, but also they're a bit dry sounding. And if you're accustomed to having a more, here's a good word for audio processing, a more juicy sound to the audio, then your presets kind of start to hit that sweet spot where there's some juiciness to the audio, if that's your preference for what you want to hear on the air.
Yeah, and in fact, for the Omnia 6, I have a new series of presets as I play around with these on the side. Whenever I get stuck with my normal work and I need a brain break, I'll go play. And I will usually play with an Omnia 6 or an Omnia 1 and see what I can do. And until I'm ready again, then I can get back to work.
By the way,
you how geeky I am with audio.
And not that all your audio presets are juicy or pump and suck sort of presets. You have one here for the Omnia 6 called NPR Pure.
Yes.
What's the idea behind this preset?
The one thing that you can, the Omnias are designed around what the majority of users have been asking from Omnia over the years. So the people that buy these Omnias and use these presets, as you say, the majority of them are happy with that sound because that's what they've been looking for. Mm-hmm. You get some other people that'll get an Omnia and they want something different. They have a different sound in mind. And either our box or the competitors or both couldn't quite get them there. And in the case of NPR Pure, that's one where it's a preset that's designed where you run it on the air, and what you get into the box is what comes out.
except it's modified for the FM transmission format, right?
Yes, exactly. It takes advantage of all the constraints of FM broadcast, and it keeps you legal and keeps you modulated, but it gives you a sound that's as close to program as you're going to get with a 6 watt while still maintaining level control of some kind. Now, to do that now, you're not going to be very loud, but most NPR people aren't worried about that. They're more worried about accuracy than loudness as far as how their audio sounds. So this gets them in the ballpark. And these presets are basically there to get you in the ballpark. You wanted a certain starting point, I give you a starting point. Great. Now, that just saved you a ton of time. You know, that's the idea behind these. And then there's another set of NPR-type stations that are, yeah, they want to be laid back, but they want a warmer sound, and that's where the newest set that I dub vinyl, in various forms of vinyl, that's what that addresses. And I call it vinyl because it's a sound that reminds me a lot of records, you know, LPs, and so that's where the name comes from. And it's a warmer vinyl LP kind of sound, just minus the clicks and pops.
I'm looking at you have a preset, Corny, for the Omnia One that's called CG Mighty 80s.
Yes,
this is one of my favorites because this one, to my ears, this one, it's very juicy. It's fat and juicy. It's like a it's like a peach that is overripe.
Yeah, the Omnia One, being part of the newer generation of processing coming out of Omnia, it's not, while it has a lot of the characteristics of a normal Omnia when you play with it, for people who's really, really dug into that thing, they were able to find that they can get all kinds of unique sounds out of it. And with me going in underneath the hood and playing around with the internal controls, I found that I can do all kinds of crazy sounds with that thing. And one night I was sitting there going, you know, I bet you I can make this sound like 1980s here when people had a wall of compressors and there was never a quiet part anywhere in the radio station, even the noise was loud. So I figured I'll go crazy and I'll just make a preset and just call it Mighty 80s.
Even
you know,
the noise was loud. That's good.
And so
that's
I just
true.
Made it,
that is true. Yeah.
I made a totally over the top preset and that one is, it gets a lot of attention, especially from Europeans who are just now, a lot of the commercial guys and a lot of pirates over there are discovering processing for the first time, it seems. And they're totally into that wound up sound now. And it's funny how many Europeans email me from time to time, say, Mighty 80s, love it, love it, love it.
I've demonstrated Mighty 80s to some broadcasters and their reaction was, what's a good starting point?
Yes, you know, I've had some people react that way, and they'll send me a preset that's more wound up than Mighty 80s. I've got this little sound here I need to tune out. Can you help me with that? It's like, wow, okay, sure, okay.
Oh, gosh.
And since then, I've made one for the Omnia 6, although the Omnia 6, it was pushing it kind of hard. So the Omnia 6 doesn't quite have the same characteristics that the Omnia 1 has with that, But yeah, there were some people that requested that for the Omnia 6 from me, so I had to come up with something there too.
You said something a moment ago about pirate radio, and seems that I saw in a report within the company a few months back that you had gone to the Netherlands to some kind of a, what do they have, a pirate radio party there.
Well, what they had there in the Netherlands was a year event. It's called Audio Processing Freak Day, and it started out as something that the pirates did, and all these pirates over in Netherlands, they have these and ranging anywhere from 5 kilowatts to 20 kilowatt pirate transmitters.
What?
And wow, they'll have these nice towers that raise up 180 meters in the air. You know, just pneumatic towers that they raise up and just go in the air. And these guys have processing chains that will put most commercial stations to shame. And these guys are running Orbans and Omnias and old, new, you know, the ultimate chain for these guys are, you know, a set of audio prisms and an 8100 and XT2 chassis just to be able to squash daylight out of the music.
That will do just fine.
Yes. And they just wind them all up. And the funny thing about it is, you know, here in the United States, you think you get a pirate and what do they play? They'll play underground rock and roll and things like that. Well, over there, you've got all that already. So these guys go and play traditional Dutch Oompa music on vinyl.
What?
Yes, and that's how you identify the pirates. If you hear Oompa music playing on the radio, it's probably a pirate. And those guys love Mighty 80s. And when I was over there, I unveiled new, you know, Omnia presets, just as something to do, you know, when I was over there to give a little speech on Omnias. Mm-hmm. And by this point, I should also add here that it's not just pirates now. You've got like half the attendees there were actual Dutch broadcasters, because there's in Netherlands, the other odd thing is that radio is so big that there's a radio station. There's more radio stations than there are people to support them. So most stations don't really make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So you've got like tons and tons. You've got national broadcasters and you've got regional broadcasters. Then you've got the local and then you have the neighborhood. And these are just licensed guys. So the radio is already packed with stations as it is. And you get the pirates on the air that will go on with 5, 10, 20 kilowatts. It's like, why do you need that much power in such a small country? And their response was to override all the other signals.
Oh, gee.
So anyway, on the freak day, just to jump back to where I am now, about half of the attendees there were actual commercial broadcasters at this point, and the other half were the pirates. And you can tell the pirates because they were just like your stereotypical pirates from like a nautical pirate movie, where they were, you know, they were the party group, you know. And so I play all these nice little presets for, you know, that were targeted towards the commercial broadcasters, and they will all nod their head and, oh, well, that sounds nice, cool. The last preset I unveiled was Mighty 80s, and that one I figured that the pirates would love. And sure enough, it was like, argh, kind of thing. You know, these cheers went up and big smiles when they heard the Mighty 80s preset, so. It was pretty wild. It was fun, and, you know, I look forward to going back there again. It was a lot of fun, though. All those guys were cool.
Cornea,
commercial and pirate.
I want to cover a bit of a subject that I get asked frequently about, and that is, okay, what's the difference in audio processing for, say, an FM station and for something that you would do for the internet or for a codec, maybe HD radio or for internet streaming? Why do I need a different processor for each thing? My quick explanation to people who ask this is, well, you have a different processor for your AM station than you do for your FM station, because we're working with two different transmission mediums, and we're trying to exploit the advantages of each, and we're trying to minimize the disadvantages in each. Same thing for when you move to internet streaming. You need to exploit what it does well and minimize what coded audio doesn't do so well. Would you expand on that for us? What are some of the key things about processing for codecs?
Well, the thing that with codec is that I touched on this a little bit earlier, in that the codecs remove most of the information and try to reconstruct audio in a way that sounds normal to our ear with almost nothing. And the reason they would do that is for, say, like take a podcast like this one, for instance. Our files are usually going to be, I assume, an MPEG format, MP3. Mm-hmm. What bit rate do our podcasts generally run?
We're just voice on this, so we do 64 kilobit MP3.
Okay. So, 64 kilobit is a tiny chunk of space for audio that in linear terms would be 1.44 megabits of data every second. And we're squeezing that down to just 64K, something that can squeeze through a modem in real time. And it, so as I was saying, the way it does that is that the codecs look for things that we wouldn't notice in the audio, the little noises in the background, the individual bands of frequencies coming out of our voices that we as humans don't notice because we're concentrating on the bulk of the voice that make a word. So this thing is removing all this data out of our voices that we normally wouldn't notice if it were gone anyway, which is the idea. And the lower you make the bit rate, the harder it gets for the codec to try to hide all that information that it's removing. So, and that's just with straight audio. Now, when you get into most of your programs now, if you were to maintain a certain level to your audio, the codec would be happier working with that versus audio where 1 second I'm loud and then we're mumbling something in the background, you've got to turn it up, and then the codec has a harder time pulling usable information out of the noise. So you get more errors, and you hear that in terms of weird jingling noises or weird boings or whatever in the audio.
Mm-hmm.
So you need processing to keep the audio at a constant level so the codec is always happy.
You know,
but you can't go over. You have a limit. You go over.
Where is that sweet spot to make the codec happy with the audio level?
You determine that by getting the peaks as loud as you can get them without going over, without overloading, because overloading causes all kinds of nasty things to happen, and the codec just falls on its face at that point. So
really,
so if you hit if you have something where you run out of headroom and your device distorts, well, that usually sounds really bizarre when it happens. Even if it's little bits of distortion, you lose quality in your voice. So
yeah,
that's where
experimenting.
Well, when something is distorted, it creates harmonics. Look at the frequency domain, and these are more things that the MP3 or AAC codec has to look at. Oh, there's information here. Now, the codec doesn't know if this is distortion or not. It could have been a trumpet, which has quite a few harmonics in the way it sounds in the frequency domain.
Absolutely.
So you definitely don't want to create distortion. Now, when you said you want to keep the level up as high as possible, I heard a bit of surprise from Chris, and actually this is something that I get asked quite a bit about. You don't want to present a codec with a wall of sound, with a big a compressed and limited and squashed wall of sound, because then there is no frequency band at any given instant that takes precedence over any others.
Exactly.
There's nothing to ignore at that point.
You need the peaks and valleys.
Yes, and that's the point I was getting at. That was working my way up to. You want to get it as high as possible, but you don't want to distort, you don't want to overload, and you don't want to have it so smashed that, as Kirk was saying, that codec has a hard time figuring out what it's going to remove, because that causes it to crank out all kinds of weird sounds for a totally different reason. So that's where the look-ahead limiters come in, where you can remove those little peaks that we don't hear anyway and that the codec wouldn't mind. If you were to record your voice, which anybody can do, even with a little sound recorder in Windows and a little microphone to your mouth if you want to try it at home, you record your voice and you'll see all these little fine peaks that come up for your voice. And if you have an editing program such as Audacity, which you can get for free on the internet, you can play games and remove those, and you can see that you can remove a surprising amount of those before you start to hear it. And with a look-ahead limiter, what that does is that it truncates those peaks. It doesn't chop them off, which is what a clipper would do, and that creates distortion, which causes problems for the codec. But it'll just turn those down instantaneously, and then it turns back up again when those peaks are out of the way. That's a very clean way of handling peaks on audio for a codec. So that makes the codec happy. You still have peaks and valleys, but the peaks aren't so wide that it's going to cause something to overload.
All right, let me see if I got something straight here. If you do clipping, you do create harmonics, which then a codec would say, oh, I have to code these.
Yes.
If you do look-ahead limiting, but you don't do it in a smart way, then by definition, you're creating intermodulation distortion.
Exactly. It's a different kind of distortion.
So I take it that you've got some way, I've heard Frank Foti talk about this, you've got some way to mitigate the creation of intermodulation distortion when you do aggressive look-ahead limiting.
Yes.
Okay. You're not going to tell me what that is, are you?
No, I'm not. That's my ancient Chinese secret.
Ah, that's the secret sauce, huh?
Yes.
Okay. So
it was just part of
yeah. Yeah. Well, by definition, just a plain look-ahead limiter worked hard enough, will create non-insignificant amounts of intramod distortion as one signal controls the other. But I guess you can also predict what that intramod distortion would be, and then hence you can probably deal with it somehow.
Yeah, and intermod distortion is a smoother form of distortion than harmonic distortion. Harmonic distortion is just that harsh sound that you get if you're have your windows down in your car in the summertime, playing your radio up, and you get it to that point where you just can't listen to it anymore, and you got to back it down. Mm-hmm. That kind of distortion is harmonic distortion. It sounded like, Chris, you had a question?
I was going to ask, how have you found in your playing around, researching, and everything else you might call it, symmetry of the waveform going into a codec? I had talked about this on one of our previous podcasts, and something I'd learned many years ago playing with POTS codecs when they first were coming out back in, what was it, 1996 or something, I had discovered that the symmetry of the waveform going in to the codec really had an effect on how it played out. And then I said, well, gee, I wonder if I go back to the days of phase scrambling on processing and say, gee, what would that do to it? Have you found that phase scrambling, yes, that was popular, it still is, I guess, actually it's being reintroduced by a lot of folks in post-production audio. Do you find phase scrambling is a benefit or a detriment in front of a codec, say an MPEG codec or AAC?
That's one of those things that I was playing around. As a hobby, I run an internet radio station, and I do, involved with podcasting, like with Kirk and the gang here, so I'm working with codecs a lot these days. And that's the one thing I'm noticing, that certain voices, the way the asymmetry is on their voices, it does cause the codecs, or some of those voices can cause a codec to do weird stuff.
I have noticed that.
Trying to hide things, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely something that I've been poking around with in the background there. It seems that if you're using a traditional processor that's got a phase rotator in there, it does seem to mitigate some of that on those voices.
Because I've also discovered certain types of microphones will also they don't do phase scrambling per se, but they somehow when they spoken word is put through the microphone and comes out the wire, if you will, it somehow manages to create a nicer sound for the codec to play with or process. I'm just throwing it out there because I've been doing a lot of stuff with audio lately for our radio stations, both for HD streaming and terrestrial, because the environment that most of our listeners nowadays listen to our radio stations in is very noisy. So I'm trying to find a way for them to crank that radio, but not introduce distortion as a result of what I'm doing.
Right. Yes, and you're right. And different microphones have different characteristics, and a lot of that is mechanical. Does the diaphragm move more easily in one direction than another? And it does. And there is some alteration in the way the voices go through those, and you have frequency response differences that will, if you change the frequency response in the voice, it also have an effect on how asymmetrical the voice will be. Either it could be more or less asymmetrical. So yeah, you're right. When you experiment with your microphones, yeah, that's the kind of things you run across.
Now, in your opinion, speaking of microphones and say the audio response of a microphone, traditionally in radio, there are one or two microphone models that are used just exclusively because that's just the way it's done. Those particular microphones have somewhat of a high frequency boost around 10 kilohertz, a little bit of a bump. It goes up 2 or 3 kilohertz and comes back down. Would you say using a microphone like that and not properly watching how you set up your codec, or maybe in the case of streaming or HD, that may actually work against you when you're trying to process your audio and create a sound that's unique or a signature over that, compared to a microphone that's relatively flat in response?
Yeah, you bring up a good point, and it's something that we address as well as the competing companies as well, where we have this process called codec conditioning. And the very thing that you're talking about, before I jump into that real quick, I'll just let that hang for the moment. When you do have these little high-frequency boosts in the microphone, what it will also amplify, not only the characteristics of voices, but things in the room, things around that will get accentuated and rammed through the codec, which will cause like jingly key sounds, you know, like some of these jingling keys in the background and things like that. Where, yes, you're right. And so what we do with codec conditioning is try to control things and just leave the audio that's in the forefront there and untouched, and try to remove some of the high frequency noises and things that are in the background to make things sound smoother on the codec.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
That kind of gets around a lot of those high frequency variations, because when you're doing a podcast or a radio broadcast or even HD broadcast, you're not in control of what microphone is being used in any given moment of time in all the production that you play. So we try to come up with something that's smart enough to look for conditions where when there's a spoken word moment, you try to remove as much as of that material that aggravates a codec as possible.
Now, speaking of that technique, is that currently available in the product lines that are coming out of the Telos Omnia plant?
The Omnia 1 has a process we call Sensus, which is a codec conditioning algorithm that controls a lot of that high-frequency material, as well as some things in the stereo domain that can cause a codec to become not so happy. And it has a few controls in there that you would adjust. And one of the controls is called a sensitivity control. So as you adjust it, you'll hear it rolling off more of the highs, and you just find that happy point between what sounds good to you and what sounds good on the codec by the time you run through the codec process.
This Sensus technology is amazing on human voice at low bit rates. That's where it really comes in. And now, Corny, it's more than just rolling off the high end. It's a dynamic process.
Yeah, it's a very smart process. It's not like a dumb roll off. It's taking into account what's going on in the program material, and it's trying to apply the right curve moment to moment to the audio.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So it's always adapting to the voices and the material that's coming in.
So then an Omnia 1, if I'm using that, I have to be careful and not set it up in a traditional audio processing manner. I have to take the approach of my environment for the audio, the source, and all the other elements that are taking place around it so that I don't have the artifacts created as a result of the encoder saying, oh, what's this? I'm going to play with this when it shouldn't.
Yes. And you can do some surprising sounds with a processor that can come close to imitating what's on the air, and some cases sound better than what's on the air because you don't have a processor dealing with preemphasis and trying to make compromises on the high end to fit the high end boost that you have for AM and FM transmission that's required.
I hate that.
Yes. So
I hate that preemphasis.
So in many ways, you'll find that on an HD broadcast or an internet broadcast or even a podcast of music, if you have processing on it, the highs tend to sound more natural and more open. So with that, it gives you a lot of leeway, and you can come up with some really nice, warm-sounding processed audio for coded audio that you really wouldn't be able to do. You can for FM, but then you'll end up being quiet. You know.
True. Hey. Have you ever, in your time of since 16 years of age, worked with audio processing using light bulbs in the feedback loop to create the compression?
One of my first compressors was that.
Excellent.
Yes, and it was a lot of fun until you get so loud that you blow the light bulb out. And then it was really loud in your ears.
True, but then you learn how to maintain that.
Yes, exactly. That's where you go, oh, how do you protect this light bulb from burning? Oh, Zener diodes, okay.
Yes. That was the best sound I ever had using light bulbs.
How is it that the time constant of a light bulb filament or perhaps an LED and an LDR, a light-dependent resistor, how does that work out to actually sound nice in AGC applications, and can you mimic that in DSP?
Well, the LDRs, if they're LEDs, they don't have it. That's just turns on and off. The light bulb has the softest knee.
Oh, okay.
That's what I found.
All right.
Yeah, light bulb. If you were to flick a light bulb off and on, or even watch like if you're in Las Vegas while the light bulbs are still in use, and just watch a light bulb and just kind of focus in on one light bulb on the side and watch it turn off and on, you'll see that it doesn't just turn on and off. It slowly lights up and then it has this decay where it's getting dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, and then it's off.
Sure.
That's the time constant of a light bulb. And it just so happens that with audio, that's a nice little curve that it has there.
It's sweet.
Not too fast. It's not too slow. It's just right. In fact, one of my fellow processing geeks, his name is David Reeves.
I know Dave.
Yeah.
He loves posting on these boards about all the light bulb compressors he's designed over the, and when he was in his youth, and how he loved that sound. And I just kind of chuckles. Yeah, those are pretty cool. But in an LDR, like the where you have the LED and a photoresistor, and those devices where the time constant comes in is in the photoresistor side.
Right.
So the photoresistor has kind of like this slow time where you get this build and then a decay, and it has a nice sound to it. But the problem is with those that you have to be careful of is that the LED can modulate it, that the off and on noise can generate distortion that can get across the photoresistor element. So they're a little trickier to deal with.
Well, I found with the LDRs, I would bias the LED so that it was always, it never turned off.
Yes,
And it was the closest I could mimic. And the product that I modified was a Texar that had way too much overshoots with the stock setup.
Mm-hmm.
But the light bulb compressor, I did do that at two radio stations in my early career days. And that compressor with the CP803 made for a very nice, loud sound that people would sit there with their Orban boxes trying to mimic and never came close.
Yes. The other problem with LED photoresistors are that the LEDs never really stay the same brightness across temperature.
Oh, you're not kidding. They almost need like a TCXO going.
Yes.
That's true. All right, good. You're a true audio processing geek. Excellent.
So, Cornel, I'm still curious. Can you mimic the response in DSP?
You know, and some of the stuff I've been working on, it's to my ear. Some of the things I've come up with comes really close to mimicking that, though I'm not doing a straight time constant like that because of the smart. So it's being modified, but the stuff I've come up with is very smooth, and a lot of people have noticed that. So, and I'm excited for the rest of the world to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Which one of your presets would that come closest to, or it's still something in the back office that you're working on?
Well, the funny thing, one of the vinyl presets come the closest, although the stuff I'm working on does have an edge over that, and there's a noticeable edge, but the vinyl things come close.
Nice.
We could talk about this for a long time, and we will again sometime. So I think we're going to have to draw this to a close. There's so much more I want to know, but the show like this does give our listeners some food to chew on and the opportunity to ask some questions. So listeners, if you want to post your questions to the website, just go to thisweekinradiotech.com and click on the link for the forum, or you can leave your comments on this particular show, Episode 6, with Cornelius Gould about audio processing. And we will do our best next time we have Corny on or some other audio processing expert to address those kinds of questions. Guys, I want to thank you very much for being here. We've been going a while here. We're going to draw it to a close. Chris Tobin from CBS Radio in New York, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Oh, you're welcome, Kirk.
And we'll hope to have you back next week. Cornelius Gould from Cleveland, Ohio, with the Research and Development Department at Omnia Audio. Corny, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I hope you'll come back. Oh, and Corny, you do a podcast or some streaming yourself. Would you like to mention what that website is?
The music stream that's up and running all the time is legatocafe.net, L-E-G-A-T-O, cafe.net.
Okay.
And that's kind of a lot of what I've been experimenting with has not been on there lately. I've just had a fixed processing chain on that for a while. But generally, in the past, a lot of people have heard me tinkering with designs on that, especially when it comes to coded audio. So, you know, you never know. You might hear me fiddling one night and say, hey, he's got something going on there.
Your other website with downloads and, thoughts about audio processing and explanations, really good explanations, including audio samples, is cgould.com.
Yes.
Right. I want to mention another website that is worthwhile. If you're curious about how good audio can sound on the internet, and you don't want to wait around for Corny to adjust his audio processing at legatocafe.net, there is a company that does a lot of streaming of pop music, popular dance music. It is they have two locations in Paris, France, and in New York City. It's called Goom. That stands for Go On Media, GOOM.com.
And David Perot is another processing geek, if you will, and he's involved with the sound on Goom Radio.
I sure intend to have David on an upcoming podcast. I think he'll be very interesting to listen to. But all of the streams that you hear, and they have, I don't know, 15 or 17 or so different programs constantly at goom.com. In the U.S., you'll be redirected to, I think, goomradio.us. But if you just type in your browser, goom.com, you can choose from the player pops up, and you can choose from different streams. And all of these streams are processed with an Omnia One. Each one is processed with a different Omnia One multicast audio processor. So you can get an idea of, does it make a difference to try to process the audio for streaming? Well, I think it does.
I would agree.
And Legato Cafe certainly has processing on that, too.
Ah, okay. I will give it a listen. I haven't yet, but I certainly will.
It may or may not be the experiment at the moment, but there's always processing on that.
Oh, okay. And so there's always audio on it, too.
Yes.
All right.
24/7.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. And listeners, thank you very much for listening. Please tell your friends. And you can also join us on Facebook. There's a fan page for This Week in Radio Tech. You can also follow me on Twitter. I do occasional updates about what we're going to be doing on This Week in Radio Tech. And my Twitter name is kharnack, kharnack. Thanks again. And you guys have a great week. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech.